This is Ralph Pointer, Ralph Shoneman, and Maya Schoen with an update on the case of Lynn Stewart. It's been quite a while, and we want to bring you up to date on what Lynn's been doing, the status of her case, and how her case relates to what's going on in the world. Ralph Pointer, you've been back and forth to Texas many times since our last update. Please give us the status of Lynn's case and how she's doing.
Well, I'm in Fort Worth, Texas right now, looking for one more visit to Lynn this week. When I ask her, "How are you doing, Lynn?" her answer always begins with, "Ralph, I'm in jail." And after, you know, a little bit of laughter, she continues with what's happening in jail. Her health is not good. We knew that when she went into jail. And of course, when she says jailhouse medical care is an oxymoron, there is no such thing. She's fighting it mentally. She is very well. She's working on other inmates' cases. She is not allowed to be an attorney, but she assists people in writing letters, and she has been successful at it. But she reminds me that even though people's dates have been changed, nobody's getting out of jail. And the biggest issue is that people who were supposed to have their sentences changed because, like, the latest Obama initiative, crack cocaine and powder cocaine are supposed to get the same sentence, and so many people of color were convicted of crack cocaine and got large sentences. And since this has been overturned, no one has gotten out of the Fort Worth jail because they announced that they haven't done their paperwork, although people should be getting out. That will reflect on everything. All of the cases that were discussed and done while she's working on them in prison, even though there are dates that people have been given, they will not get out on the date because the paperwork has not been done.
Ralph, I'd like to return to Lynn's actual status. Before she went to jail, she was due to have an operation. And as we've reported before, the court refused to allow her out and the time to have that operation.
Well, they wouldn't even allow the operation to proceed before her bail was revoked and she was remanded to prison. In short, she was scheduled to have an operation at a major hospital in New York. And notwithstanding that, the court failed to permit that to proceed and required her imprisonment before a scheduled operation for which she had a dire need was allowed to take place.
And as a result, you know, Lynn is such a trooper and you're such a trooper that we're really understating the actual situation of Lynn's health. She's had medical crises in September and October. And thanks to her family, particularly her daughter and you, she's overcome these crises. But she's been back and forth to the clinic. She's been bedridden at times. And she's had severe infections.
They didn't even inform her when there was an appropriate medication waiting at the pharmacy. She's been deprived of the medication she needs. And the medication is only part of the issue because it's the actual surgery that she requires. And so she's made to endure a condition for which she is not treated appropriately and for which the surgery that is essential is prevented from taking place. This is not just prison per se. This is a specific and vicious political act. It's an adequate reflection of the nature of this system and the intention of the people in power.
And as predictable, her condition worsens.
So, Ralph, I understand that you and your daughter and the lawyers are having a full campaign to make it so that Lynn can have the required operation. Is there something that we all can do to help you in this effort?
Well, as Lynn says, the Bureau of Prisons is numbed in terms of the requests of the inmates, all of them, not only Lynn Stewart. She witnessed the death of a woman who was on a dialysis machine, and you know all of the complications that get involved there. And the woman got very ill, and they tried to get one of the nurses, there were two nurses on duty, to administer to her. She claimed of being in pain. Lynn helped her down the hallway, and they ended up in the restroom across the hall from the nurse's quarter. She went to get the nurses. They said, she's just faking it. Nothing is wrong with her. This is the woman who was ill on the dialysis machine. And as a result, when the nurse came very late, she died on the bathroom floor with Lynn there. And as Lynn said to me, Ralph, I do not want to go that way. This is the nature of prison health care. And as Lynn says, it's an oxymoron. And so, yes, Lynn's health is worsening. She grins and bears it. If the operation had taken place, she would have been comfortable, more comfortable in her body. And as a result, the operation that is necessary has not taken place. And we are trying to get them to send her to one of the local hospitals to get this operation. And to date, no success. So letters might help, but as Lynn says, they care not and they need not care. This is the nature of the American prison system.
Yes, on that score, many, many months ago, Lynn listed me as a person who would have the right to visit her. And as you know, I did visit her when she was at MCC. I have not heard to date, and is it true that they are restricting her visitors to just the immediate family?
Yes, they have just opened it up slightly now, and they're putting a few names on the list. But as Jill Elijah now works for the New York State prison system, she was a lawyer representing Marilyn Buck. She said to me once in a phone conversation, she doesn't know whether it's the water they drink down here in Texas, whether they're just plain mean, whether they're lazy. It's very difficult to get anything done in the hospital that would alleviate the suffering of the inmates here. So I can only concur that this has been our experience. We try. Zenobia has been here. Zenobia's on the phone. They have over-medicated her to the degree whether whenever she gets a medication or a change in medication, she calls me, I call Z, Z calls me back, Lynn calls me again, and then I tell her what to take and what not to take. Because, as she said, medical health care in the prison is an oxymoron, does not happen, and but for our doctor daughter, I fear for Lynn.
Well, to give the flavor of this, as Lynn wrote to Maya and me recently, the operation I was to have and the appellate court disallowed permitted the bladder uterus problems to come back. I got a severe infection that they did not treat until a month and a half after I first reported it. I had mutual antibiotics to which I am resistant, and they hadn't done a culture. They continued their carelessness by failing to tell me that I had medication waiting at the pharmacy. So to give the flavor here, this is not just bureaucratic incompetence. This is a malicious and deliberate prevention of even the most elementary treatment. As Lynn says, what I really need is the procedure, and I assume once I'm cured of the infection, it'll come back. So you have a chronic situation which is exacerbated by this willful, not merely neglect, but denial of appropriate treatment for the infection that she's been enduring. This is a serious matter. And why or how the courts cannot be challenged and attorneys launch legal demands is beyond my understanding.
And, Ralph, while we're on delays, a date still hasn't been set for the argument at the appellate court. What is the status?
We are looking forward to that. Although we know there is no law, I think what a court appearance does is it teaches the country or anybody who is interested the status of the lack of law in the country. So here the appeal was supposed to be heard in September and October. We have passed September and October, and there is no word. I just request that the appeal will be heard in New York, in which Lynn will not appear. I would like to occupy the courthouse the night before and the morning of the hearing that comes up. So we're still waiting with bated breath,
And this is an appeal of the appeal, essentially, because the appellate court had overturned Judge Codal's sentence and increased Lynn's sentence.
From 28 months to 120 months. And she, in November of this year, she will have done 2 years, 24 months.
24 months. It's incredible. 24 months for an attorney who is the people's attorney and was only doing her job.
Well,
in reference to the appeal and Lynn, and the fact that there still is no date for argument, Lynn wrote to us and alerted us of the recent decision of the 11th Circuit Court in Atlanta. This is the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, in which they considered an appeal by both Jose Padilla's attorneys for the case in Florida and also the district attorneys in that case about whether or not there was a conviction for Padilla and his co-defendants and whether or not the sentence was appropriate. And the three-judge panel of this 11th Circuit and consequently a majority of the two, came down with a ruling that just as in Lynn's case, that the sentence of the judge in the case was not sufficient. They said the sentence was substantively unreasonable and that there should be a much larger sentence than what the judge had handed down. And the judge had already handed down a 17-year prison sentence, imposing that on Jose Padilla for a vacuous case. And yet, this 11th Circuit said that this did not meet the federal sentencing guides for terrorism cases.
Well,
this,
I wanted to
Lynn
comment
Fields
on that,
does not bode well for her own appeal.
We should alert our listeners to some basic issues pertaining to the case of Jose Padilla and the ominous implications of a decision by an appellate court that 17 years is not sufficient. Jose Padilla was kidnapped by the U.S. government and held in isolation on a ship where he was subjected for 2 years of total sensory deprivation, where he could no longer distinguish what was an outside noise and what was coming from inside his head, where he's literally driven mad with constant bombardment of images and messages that were designed to derange him, and did indeed. He couldn't tell when he was being spoken to by a person in his presence or from the messages that were being put through ear devices into his head. Day and night, deprived of sunlight, day and night in total darkness, day and night in total isolation, until he was no longer able to tell what was real and what was not. That was the condition in which he was maintained. That was the torture to which he was subjected, a fiendish torture, which they literally destroyed the man's mind. When he was talking to his attorneys, he didn't know if they were in front of him, and he was convinced that they were part of the government torture of him.
Ralph, we should point out that this took place in a North Carolina brig, and yet the conditions of Jose Padilla in the brig were not allowed into the Florida case. In fact, the entire capture of Jose Padilla, ostensibly for the dirty bomb, was that this was dropped. He was never tried on that. He was tried along with two others for supposed conspiracy to murder people on foreign soil. To go to the sentence and what relates to Lynn's case, the circuit courts and what the appellate court in Lynn's case are saying is that the judge imposing a sentence in a case no longer has the discretion that historically has been allocated to judges in criminal cases. In other words, the appellate courts are taking upon themselves the right to sentence prisoners. This is a vast change in the U.S. judicial system.
But it has another fundamental implication that is quite analogous to the way in which Lynn Stewart has been demonized and subject to what is basically the architecture of the fascist state. The orchestrated claims and charges against Padilla that he was involved in plotting the release in the United States of what is called a dirty bomb, for which there was never a scintilla of evidence, was completely dropped. They never attempted to provide any evidence that could sustain this claim, and in fact they shifted it to his presumptive conversations on the telephone with people he knew in Cairo about his sympathy for the Islamic movement. But even in those conversations, he never made any direct reference nor in any way communicated anything about aid for armed action, aimed for actions against individuals. It was strictly an expression of his religious convictions, no political content whatsoever. That was the shift to which the government made, because they couldn't produce any evidence in trial for the dirty bomb charge. So for literally 2 years, the media had blanketed the world with the claims that this man had been was being held for his involvement in a plot to release a dirty bomb. Then in the actual trial, none of that is produced, and the so-called evidence has to do with phone calls to people that he knew that had no bearing on anything in Afghanistan, no bearing in regard to any of the conflicts of the United States, specifically or politically. This is a man who, when he was being defended in a court, his lawyers, as you mentioned, were not allowed to inform the jury of what I'm just describing, let alone the torture to which he was subjected. This was not permitted into the courtroom. And then a sentence on this basis is handed down for 17 years. And to give you the flavor, the jurors dressed up in an American flag in the first two rows, given the drumbeat of propaganda from the state. In this charade, this Alice in Wonderland charade, a sentence of 17 years was handed down to this innocent, tormented man, and this appellate court rules that that's not enough? And Lynn Stewart has been convicted of defending a man equally innocent of the charges that were, in fact, of government origin, the so-called Landmarks plot and the so-called claim of plotting to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. They didn't produce a scintilla of evidence to associate Sheikh Abdulrahman with those charges. They couldn't. There is none except for the role of government informers who actually prepared the operation for the FBI and for Egyptian intelligence. The Padilla case is a paradigm of the charade that goes by the name of the court system in this arbitrary sentencing of Lynn, assimilating her to the charge of her client, who was innocent of the charge in the first place.
The only comparison to Padilla with Lynn Stewart is that they are both used to frighten the American people with the boogeyman of terrorism. And Lynn's crime is not only did she defend the blind sheikh in a successful manner, she also showed that the American government were the guilty ones in this so-called conspiracy to blow up New York City landmarks. So Lynn is guilty of a double crime, being too proactive in working for her client and being successful, and also showing the government complicity in this, like I say, raising of the boogeyman to frighten the American people into compliance. But one of the differences in then and now is the American people have seen what has happened when they go for this boogeyman terrorism and they lose their homes, their jobs. That which was considered to be justice, that is gone. They lose privacy. And now this is where we are. So there is the difference, and we hope that that difference is waking people up to what is the real problem here. It is not the boogeyman of terrorism. It is the reality of the American injustice system.
And in this context, I want to mention that the basis for the appellate court's, first of all, refusal to allow Lynn to remain on bail while the case was sub judice, but secondly, and more seriously and sinister yet, was their ruling that Lynn had made herself an agent of terror by virtue of the fact that she had released a public press release in which the sheikh was allowed to express his views on the state of affairs in his native country, Egypt. And the irony of this is that the plot of which Sheikh Abdulrahman was falsely accused and for which Lynn has been put in jail because she defended him against those false charges, that plot to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993, the so-called Landmarks plot to blow up the United Nations and the George Washington Bridge and the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel and the United Nations and to assassinate the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Boutros-Ghali, and the former Senator Alphonse D'Amato, all of this charade is this absurd array of charges. The Sheikh had zero to do with this. On the contrary, it was an intelligence operative of Mubarak and of the Federal Bureau of Investigation who organized these plots, who enticed people into coming to meetings to discuss them, who provided all of the safe house and the rental van. From the beginning to the end, a government FBI operation and arrangement. And when Lynn attempting, along with Ramsey Clark, to give voice to the Sheikh's innocence and to allow him to address what was really going on in Egypt, for which he was being targeted and made the scapegoat in this fashion, when the Sheikh was being asked how should the people respond, particularly in his movement, to the daily violence, government violence in Egypt, to the torture of people, to their disappearance, to being shot down in cold blood, to their family members being disappeared. And the Sheikh said you should use your own judgment as to how appropriately now to respond to that. That was fathered upon Lynn as an example of her assimilating the program of terror. What was the program of terror? It was the response of people to the brutality of the Mubarak regime and its U.S. and Israeli sponsors. And nothing elucidates this more clearly than this recent statement that was published in The Guardian in Great Britain from comrades from Cairo addressing the Occupy movement from the occupiers of Tahrir Square to all those across the world currently occupying parks and squares and other spaces. Your comrades in Cairo are watching you. Having received so much advice from you, we thought it's our turn to pass on some advice of our own. Indeed, we are now in many ways involved in the same struggle. What pundits have called the Arab Spring has its roots in demonstrations and riots and strikes and occupations that are now taking place all over the world. But its foundations lie in years of struggle by people and popular movements. And the moment that we find ourselves is nothing new. We in Egypt have been fighting a system of repression and disenfranchisement and the unchecked ravages of global capitalism. Yes, we say it, capitalism. A system that has made a world that is dangerous and cruel to its inhabitants. An entire generation across the globe has grown up realizing rationally and emotionally that we have no future in the current order of things. We have watched as our resources, our industry, our public services, our very livelihoods have sold off and been dismantled. An addiction to foreign goods, foreign food, and the profits and benefits going where? Elsewhere. While our country and other countries in the South find their immiseration reinforced by a massive police repression and endless torture. The current crisis in America and Western Europe has begun to bring this reality home to you as well. That as things stand, we all work ourselves raw, our backs broken by debt and public austerity. And not content with carving up the remnants of a public sphere, capitalism and the authority state now attack the private realm. Your right to decent dwellings, as untold numbers of people find their homes foreclosed and find themselves homeless and indebted to banks who have forced them on the streets. So we stand with you. We are not protesting. Who is there to protest to? What could we ask that they would grant? We are occupying. We are reclaiming the spaces of public practice that have been commodified, privatized, and locked in the hands of a faceless bureaucracy of tormentors under police protection. Hold on to your spaces. Nurture them. Expand them. Let the boundaries of your occupation grow. Who built these parks and these plazas and these buildings? Whose labor made them real and viable? There is a direct conflict between what we seek to make of our cities and our spaces and what this so-called law and the system of policing would have us do. Those who said the Egyptian revolution was peaceful did not see the horrors that have been visited upon us. They did not see our resistance and the force that revolutionaries used against these police to defend our tentative occupations and spaces. By the government's own admission, 99 police stations were put to the torch. Thousands of police cars were destroyed. All of the ruling party's offices around Egypt were burnt down. We erected barricades. Officers were beaten back and pelted with rocks as they fired on us with live ammunition. But at the end of the day, on the 28th of January, they retreated and we had won our cities. It is not our desire to participate in violence, but it is even less our desire to lose. And if we do not resist actively, when they come to take what we have won, we will surely lose. Do not confuse the tactics that we use when we shouted peaceful with fetishizing nonviolence. If the state had given up immediately, we would have been overjoyed. But they seek to abuse us and beat us and kill us, and we know that there is no other option but to fight back. Had we laid down and allowed ourselves to be arrested, tortured, and martyred, we would be no less bloodied, beaten, and dead. Be prepared. Defend the things you have occupied. Expand them. Continue with what you are building, because after everything else has been taken from us, the spaces you reclaimed are so very precious. So our real advice to you is to continue, keep going, do not stop, and fight back. Occupy more. Find each other. Build larger and larger networks. Keep discovering ways to experiment with consensus and democracy and discover new ways to use these spaces and to hold on to them and never give them up again. Resist first fiercely when you are under attack, as you will be, but take pleasure in what you are doing. We are watching one another now, and from Cairo we say, we are in solidarity with you, and we love you all for what you are doing. Now, what does that express but a voice of people that Lynn Stewart was defending when she defended the Sheikh, a voice of a people that was tormented by torturers with the trappings of office and power? That is what her crime was, and that expression from the movement in Egypt is her vindication, no less than when Fidel Castro said to the judge, "History will absolve me." The Egyptian masses are in uprising, are not merely absolving, but vindicating Lynn Stewart and indicting the terrorist in chief, Obama, and his attorney general, Mr. Holder, who was the lawyer for the death squads in Colombia and the companies that were financing them. Those are the relationships. That's what this is about with respect to Lynn, the voice of the voiceless, the defender of the Egyptian masses, vindicated by history, and now on trial for the very thing that people around the world are resisting, understanding, and prepared to remove and overthrow.
And Ralph, since you are in Texas, please send to Lynn directly the appreciation, the solidarity, and the love of all of us. We are all there with her.
I certainly will, and I'm reminded that in the words of the judge who said that Lynn, while on the witness stand, proved that she was a terrorist when she said, "When the people are under the heel of the boot of oppression, they will rise up and throw it off." And no more prophetic words can be said, and yet she is being punished for those prophetic words. The people of Egypt rose up and have begun to throw off the heel of the boot of oppression, not only in Egypt, but around the world and here in America. And for that, she sits in jail.
This has been Ralph Poynter, Ralph Schoenman, and Maya Schoen, with an update on the case of Lynn Stewart. We thank all of you who've been in steady contact with Lynn and supporting her in her travails while she is in prison in Texas. Remember, it is all our efforts that will get Lynn out of prison. Keep up the work. Silon dokh mi walan.